Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, environmental lawyer Thomas Lindsay, asks a very important question. Why isn't activism working? He says we've spent 40 years perfecting our roles as regulators, consumers, and investors, and yet we have little to show for it. Why is that? Why has our activism failed so miserably to not only build the world we want, but even to draw a line in the sand to keep things from getting worse? We often hear that if we just get enough people to write letters to our politicians or get enough people to take to the streets, we'll force those in power to do the right thing. But he says we're in this mess not only because we don't live in a democracy, but because we've never had a democracy in this country, and the Constitution is a big part of the problem. But there are solutions. Thomas Lindsay says we need to replace corporate minority decision-making with community self-government. The question is, how do we go about that? In his new book, Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community, he writes, the history of our progress as a people has always involved unhappy citizens coming together to improve their lives. And in order to create true change, citizens must learn to recognize the complex structure of laws and governance that buffers corporations, which often control the decisions affecting an overall community. Thomas Lindsay is an environmental lawyer, co-founder of the Daniel Pennick Democracy School and the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. And Thomas Lindsay joins us from KPBX in Spokane, Washington. Hi, Thomas. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us on the show, Russ.
It's great to have you. And later in the show, we'll be joined by Shannon Biggs with Global Exchange's Community Rights Program. And we'll also be joined by Eric Belcastro, an organizer with the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. So, Thomas, why don't we start off by talking about how you got to where you are today? It's a really interesting story. You grew up in Mobile, Alabama. And as a first-year law student in Pennsylvania, you persuaded a former lawyer for the Environmental Protection Act to take you on as a research assistant. And I understand that you dug through hundreds of law review articles and investigated corporate polluters. And that's when you started to really learn how the system works.
Sure. It's been a long and tortured journey, as it is for most recovering environmental lawyers, I think. but the journey that started in law school was really connected with a couple hundred different community organizations across the state of Pennsylvania who needed help stopping landfills or toxic waste incinerators or hog factory farms, those types of things that were coming into their communities. And it's a weird fact. It's a kind of a discouraging fact at this point in the United States, but the statistics are the same now as they were 20 years ago, which is there's only 200 full-time public interest environmental lawyers in the United States today. And that means that a lot of communities that are facing these kinds of corporate threats to their communities can't afford legal help to fight these projects from coming in. And so as third-year law students, myself and one or two other law students at Widener Law School, where I went to law school in central Pennsylvania, began being approached by those communities who needed help. And first we had to explain to them that to actually practice law at that point would be legal because we weren't licensed to practice law. That was the first step. The second step was to attempt to teach them how to do law themselves. In other words, take them through the law library, teach them how to write a legal brief, how to argue in front of a judge, those types of things. And it was at that point that we began to understand that environmental law is really an expertise practiced by a relatively small number of practitioners. And unfortunately, when we come into a community to help them out and do a permit appeal or do some other kind of legal action on their behalf, and then we leave, we take that residue of knowledge with us. And there's no real sustainability occurring in terms of independent people in their own communities understanding how the law operates and taking it into their own hands. And I think that was the first lesson that we learned in this long journey of ours. The second lesson was that that people needed legal help, even if it was just to teach them how to take the law into their own hands. And so we set up the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund to do something that we thought at that point in time was quite simple, which was to provide free legal services to conservation-based community organizations. And as you can imagine, when you hang your shingle out and it says free legal services, especially on environmental issues, that you have a line that queues up around the block, like waiting for concert tickets to try to obtain services. And at one point in period of 1995 to 1999, we were servicing over 300 community groups across Pennsylvania. Mm. And when I say servicing or helping them out, what we were doing was these folks would come to us and they'd say, we want you to stop. We want you to help us stop this 15,000 head hog factory farm that's coming into our community, because our vision of sustainable agriculture, sustainable farming in our community doesn't include a 15,000 head hog factory farm operated by one of the four agribusiness corporations that control 70% of pork production in this country. And by and large, our comment was always the same back to them after that first initial phone call, which was, well, we're sorry, under the existing law, under existing environmental law, you can't frontally say no to these things coming in. But what you can do is appeal the permit that's been issued by the state agency to allow the corporation to put the facility into that particular area. And that answer left us very unsatisfied, to say the least, which is it led to continued evolution and research on our part about why communities don't have the authority to say no. Why can't a community in central Pennsylvania pass a local law that bans all factory farms from coming into their community? Why can't a municipality adopt a law that bans natural gas fracking within the municipality? Why can't a community like Spokane, Washington, pass a local ordinance, a local law that bans all big box stores from siting within their community? And the answer is wrapped up in this thing called corporate rights, which is that today in the United States, corporations have certain rights that in essence place their rights over the rights of people that live in the community itself. Which means that we're in this very curious position where we as communities seem to have less rights than a handful of people who are coming into our community to vacuum out resources and exploit it, that there's a special layer of law that exists in the United States today that corporations can use that preferences them over the people that live in the communities. And so, for example, if a city like Los Angeles passed an ordinance that banned big box stores in the city, the first thing that happens is Costco or Walmart or Kmart or one of the big box stores sues the city, contending that the ordinance that they've passed violates the corporation's constitutional rights in the United States. And not only can they sue to overturn the ordinance that's been adopted, but they can sue for something called future lost profits that have been lost as a result of the ordinance being passed. And so as a community, you're kind of at the mercy of, you know, 3 or 5 or 7 or 11 people sitting on a board of directors 3,000 miles away from you who have been privileged by this special status of law that we have in this country over the people in the communities who want to build sustainability by, for example, building vibrant downtowns, which Walmart destroys. And so in a way, by not being able to say no to these things coming in, we can't say yes to the kinds of futures that we want. And that's the biggest problem that we came to in this work, trying to figure out how to solve that.
Well, and it's so amazing when you put it this way, because you take this all the way back to the 1600s and you say that the Constitution itself is part of the problem.
Sure. And in our democracy schools, which are these 2-day trainings, which we run 24 states across the United States, we talk not just about the 1600s, but we go all the way back to 1066. And, you know, some people roll their eyes and say, oh, my God, what do you mean you're starting at 1066? It's only 9:30 in the morning, you know, on a Saturday when we teach these things. But 1066 was the Norman invasion of England. And the 1066 started what's known as English common law, which is the system of English law that grew and evolved to a point where it supported colonization by England of other countries like the Caribbean and other places, to in essence set up a system where England and other colonial powers were exploiting these other areas and using English common law to legalize the vast amount of violence and exploitation that happened under that system. And it's unfortunate, but at the point in time when our lawyers and most of the folks putting the U.S. Constitution together were lawyers, that by the time our lawyers got around to drafting the U.S. Constitution, that all the law books were in English. You know, they were all English law books, and all our lawyers were trained in English law. You'll find quotes from the quote-unquote founding fathers at the U.S. Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia where they say English common law is the best law ever produced on the planet. And what we need to do is replicate that English common law within the U.S. system of law to make America the best country ever and to exploit the resources that we have in the United States. Because After all, at the time of the writing of the Constitution, people looked out at the vast landscape that was America, and they saw these almost unlimited bounty of natural resources. Mm-hmm. And to become a great country in the world, the job was to exploit those natural resources, turn them into products, create an export economy, and eventually grow to become a powerful country.
And here we are.
And here we are. And so it's those values that went into the U.S. constitutional structure, and English common law is known, if known for nothing else, is known for a system of law that elevates the rights of property and commerce above the rights of people, communities, and nature. And that's the structure that we're stuck with today.
And I love that you draw the connection back to history, because you also say that English law served to enable the English Empire to expand, which meant stifling dissenting majorities at home. And you also quote James Madison as saying it ought to be so constituted as to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. And that's a key quote.
Yeah, it's hard to take back those words. It's like the current Republican challengers trying to take back words they said 5 years ago. But, in democracy school, we say don't take our word for it. You know, since kindergarten, we've had the IV drip in our arm that tells us that the founding fathers were the smartest people that ever trod the planet.
Right.
That most people believe the U.S. is the only country that has a constitution. But when you go back and you actually read the words, and you can buy the minutes now from the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia called Madison's Notes. He took almost verbatim notes of the U.S. constitutional proceedings in Philadelphia that you can buy them for $20 at your local bookstore or wherever else you buy books. And you can read through it and actually see what Dickinson said and what Madison said and what some of the other folks inside that room said. We have to understand that the U.S. Constitution didn't come out of nowhere either. It came out of a series of events that started with George Washington, who was seeking to build canals on his 63,000 acres of trans-Appalachia land that he owned. And to actually develop that land, which he believed, honestly, in his heart, to be in the best interests of the United States, to develop the land and promote commerce, that he went to two states, Maryland and Virginia, to get permission to incorporate a corporation to build those canals. And he also sought a state subsidy from those legislatures to build those canals as well. The states quarreled amongst each other for about 10 years before George was able to get the charter for the corporation. And at that point, George said to himself, wow, these states are pretty incompetent. We need a centralized federal power that has power and authority over commerce within the United States. And that gave birth to the Annapolis Convention and a conference at Mount Vernon. And eventually that commercial drive to set up a centralized federal government system resulted in the U.S. constitutional structure that we have today. And it still amazes me, but people extol the Constitution today, you know, from our side of the philosophical realm. They extol the Bill of Rights, which is, you know, sometimes we don't remember that the Bill of Rights had to be driven in over the opposition of the people that wrote the Constitution because they didn't want the Bill of Rights in there. But the structure of the Constitution itself, which contains things like the Commerce Clause, which allows corporations to override communities in the name of commerce, all that crap is still in the text. And so we have this 1790s Constitution that is not going to take us into the sustainability future that we all want and need, I think.
So speaking of the future, whenever we do shows about the environment, our guests often say if we only enforce the Clean Air and the Clean Water Acts, we'd be doing much better than we are right now. But what you point out is that these laws, and we have so many of them, and they all sound good. We've got a lot in California, and we'll talk about that later in the show. They've actually legalized environmental harms by shifting the focus away from the harms themselves to regulating how much pollution or destruction of nature is allowed. And we don't often look at it that way.
It's a very controversial topic because people, especially the existing environmental groups, tend to tout that line, which is, well, we have the laws, we just need to enforce them.
Right.
Well, the unfortunate part about that is that what you just said, which was that the laws are more about legalizing certain things that would be illegal otherwise. So dumping a phosphorus into a waterway, for example, might be illegal without the Clean Water Act being in place, because the Clean Water Act actually allows permits to be written to legalize the dumping of the phosphorus into the rivers. And so it's our position, and it's very controversial, especially with environmental circles, which is why we get booted out of conferences sometimes. But what we always say is that there's never been an environmental movement in the United States, because movements are about taking things that are treated under the law as property and actually transforming them into rights-bearing entities. So, for example, the abolitionists, which is one of the movements we talk about in our democracy schools, they weren't about setting up a slavery protection agency that merely regulated the number of lashes a slave could receive during a given day. They were about something more fundamental than that. They were about shifting African Americans from being treated as property under the constitutional structure to being treated as persons under the constitutional structure. And the suffragists were the same. The suffragists sought to take women from being treated as property under the Constitution, keeping in mind that rape wasn't a crime in this country in the 1800s. It was a property damages crime. So if you committed rape, you paid property damages to the husband, just the same way that murder of a slave was not possible in the early 1800s, because murder of a slave was not murder. It was a property damage crime, and properties were paid to the owner. In this country, we've never talked about nature having rights or ecosystems having rights. And it's in that vein that I don't think we've ever had an environmental movement in this country, because we've never talked about ecosystem rights. And it's unfortunate, because the conversation gets stymied to, should we put another regulatory regime in place or should we not? Rather than saying, hey, maybe this whole system is bad because, in essence, it's being harnessed by some of the people that are destroying the environment currently by legalizing and permitting what they're doing. And it's gotten so outrageous, it's gotten so absurd, that there are two stories that come to mind. One is that permits that are issued to these corporations are sometimes done retroactively. So I remember a couple times in our legal practice back in the 1990s when we would catch somebody doing something, and the environmental agency would retroactively fax a permit over to the corporation to do what we had caught them doing. And so you have to wonder why, you know, even when working perfectly, the environmental regulatory system is merely regulating the rate at which we destroy the ecosystems. And so we're stuck in that position about we need to find a new way to do environmental.
You know, and I would love people who work for environmental groups, because we've got so many in our backyard. I'd love for them to call in. If you work for an environmental, I'll just give out the phone number. It's 866-798-8255. If you work for an environmental organization, or if you're an environmentalist, what do you think about Thomas Lindsay's explanation about why things just are not working? Or do you think they are working? Because we have seen some victories, maybe not some of the victories we'd like, but there are some sort of piecemeal victories. What are your thoughts about his arguments about why activism doesn't work, and that we need to completely restructure the entire system and talk about giving the ecosystem actual rights? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And the main question we're really asking is, how do we get what we want in our communities? How do we take back our power from the bottom up? And if you're a community organizer and you're working on some of these issues, what do you think really works? And if you have any questions about the law, because as Thomas says, it's got to go back to the Constitution and really understand some of these English laws and look at how they were written. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So Thomas, just quickly, what do you think of some of these environmental groups? We've got the Sierra Club, Earth Justice, the Earth Island Institute. I mean, they're all different and they're all doing different work, but overall, what do you think of the environmental movement?
Well, I don't think there is one. And I think a lot of the environmental groups, at least the big ones, and so we're talking about the really big environmental groups, you know, the Big Green that we talk about that operates in Washington, D.C., have really committed themselves to working within the system rather than working outside the system. And if they don't change gears on that, we're screwed. And when I say we're screwed, one of the points that we talk about in the democracy schools is that things are worse by almost every major environmental statistic in the United States today. Things are worse now than they were 40 years ago, before we adopted the major environmental laws in this country. And so something isn't working. And in fact, we tend to take aim at getting crumbs within the system and calling them victories, when in reality, we're just watching massive ecosystem collapse happen across the planet. And we're, in essence, doing very little to stop it. And in fact, the regulatory regime, at least in our opinion, is accelerating that ecosystem collapse. So we need to take our heads out of our butts, and we need to say to ourselves that sustainability means not only doing personal change, like recycling and changing shower heads and light bulbs and things like that, but it actually means doing activism in our own municipalities to seize our local communities and turn them upwards against a system of law that is dedicated to destroying the ecosystems and democracy where we live. And the exciting thing to me is, and up till now, you know, we've talked about more or less academic stuff. What's the theory? You know, what's the Constitution? How does it play out? Those types of things. The issue to us is more how to, and for lack of a better word, how to weaponize that understanding. Mm-hmm. How to actually begin working with communities to seize municipal structures of law, to actually build the type and of the structure of law that we need that actually accelerates sustainability rather than stopping it. And one of the things I said at a conference last year that I've never said it as compact before as this, and I was frustrated by the audience, that's why I said it, is that I said sustainability is currently illegal in the United States. The structure of law that we have renders sustainability, real sustainability, true sustainability, renders it illegal in this system. And the activism we need to do at the community level needs to make sustainability legal. In other words, harness the law itself to drive us towards sustainability rather than the law being harnessed in the name of what one historian has called the endless production of more, which he sees as the number one overriding value of this system that we have today, is that the law is harnessed to guarantee the endless production of more, which means that when we actually try to stop fracking or stop toxic waste landfills or stop something else from happening in our community, we're seen as standing in the way of the one overriding value that the system has been built around, which is this endless production of more. We need to change that. And the question becomes, how do we change it? Well, we change it by, in essence, openly defying those doctrines of law that have been concocted by corporations over the past 150 years to actually keep us in a subordinate status to those corporations. And those four doctrines, just very quickly, we've talked about some of them already. One is corporate rights, this concept that corporations are persons or have been declared to be persons under the law, which gives them access to the Constitution to overturn what we do in communities towards sustainability. The second is preemption, and this always comes as a surprise to most lawyers, you know, that we're taking on concepts of preemption because it's embedded in us since kindergarten that the federal preempts the state, the state preempts the local, without really asking the question about how democratic is that system when a smaller and smaller handful of people further up the line can actually preempt or nullify what happens at the smaller units of government. And right now, the corporate boys play us like a shell game, laughing all the way to the bank, which is they work with the federal government or the state government to preempt all of our community lawmaking. And so when communities rise up to work on, let's say, banning genetically modified seeds from their communities, the corporate boys go to work at the state legislature. They pass a law that preempts the communities from doing so. And we just accept it because we say, oh, well, it's just preemption and that's just the way the system works. Well, that's crap. And we need to reexamine that theory as well. The third of the four is something called Dillon's Rule. It sounds very academic and abstract, but in reality, it's a doctrine that corporations use to say that municipalities and our communities where we live can't do anything, can't pass any law unless we're specifically authorized to do so by the state or the federal government. And so, again, the corporations work at the state and federal level to make sure we're so circumscribed that anything we do to stop fracking or factory farms or toxic waste incinerators or whatever, that is prevented in doing so by the state and federal levels.
And, Thomas, hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about how to put all of this into practice, and we will also talk about success stories. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. This is your call. We'll be back after this.
Your call on KALW San Francisco, the nation's oldest educational FM radio station on the air since 1941. And today, KALW can be heard beyond the FM band. So if our 1900 watts aren't always enough to reach you, just click on the Listen Live link at kalw.org and find out how easy it is to listen to KALW online. That's also where you can find out about the free Public Radio Player application for the iPhone, which lets you listen to KALW and other public radio stations. And thank you for listening to and supporting your local public radio station, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. Tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss media coverage of the National Defense Authorization Act, which was recently signed by President Obama. We'll also talk about coverage of the escalating political tensions in Libya. Next week, we're putting shows together about the Democratic Party and what they stand for. We're doing shows about how to get health care, especially if you're uninsured or underinsured. We'll be talking about the marijuana industry in California and the federal crackdown and liberal support for Ron Paul. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about how to get what you want in your community. We're talking about why activism, so much activism, hasn't really worked in the last 40 years. What will it take to get real change in your communities? We're speaking with Thomas Lindsay, environmental lawyer and co-founder of the Daniel Pennick Democracy School, named in honor of Danny Pennick, a teenager from Berks County, Pennsylvania, who died of sludge poisoning. Thomas is also a founder of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, which was founded to help people research environmental laws and prepare for permit appeals. And now I would like to welcome Shannon Biggs to the show. Shannon is director of Global Exchange's Community Rights Program, and she is also, author of The Rights of Nature, the Case for a Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth. Hi, Shannon. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. So you heard Thomas really spell out what we're dealing with in terms of the law. How do you take all of this information and what you're up against and apply it in sort of real life situations? How do you put it into practice?
It's a good question. I think one of the things I do is as a community organizer here in California, my job is very similar to what the organizers at the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund do in other states. And of course I partner with them to do this work. And I know we've talked a lot about the law and passing these ordinances, but really the change has to come much deeper. It's not just about passing a law that says communities come first and placing corporate interests below the needs of communities and nature. It's really about a change of consciousness in those communities. The law is really, in some ways, a tool for that change. So when communities call me every week, you know, we get a number of calls here in the office in San Francisco from around the state. Some people are dealing with gas fracking coming in. Some people are looking at pesticides or the fact that they can't give raw milk that to their neighbor without buying $40,000 worth of equipment to make it legally sanctioned, which really speaks to that idea of sustainability being illegal that Thomas talked about. And we get a lot of communities, including folks like Santa Monica, who want to be a model sustainable city. So the things that bring people to my door and to the door at the Legal Defense Fund are many, but the conversion that takes place is that the problem itself isn't gas fracking. That's not the problem. Mm. The problem isn't water withdrawal. The problem is that we as communities do not have the authority under current law to make decisions about gas fracking and to make decisions about the quality of life in the places where we live. And so it's a transformation from saying, oh, I work on water issues or fracking issues, to saying the real root issue is that, as Thomas so clearly, you know, pointed out, how do we actually put ourselves in the driver's seat of what happens to us in the places where we live? And it's that, it's those conversations that I have. And you know, we have democracy schools throughout California as well, which give that really that deeper understanding. And when communities are really ready to take this on, a lot of communities do opt to hold a democracy school to get that sort of deep, that deeper understanding of what the issues are and what's really standing in the way. But the law is really, it's confronting the entire system. Mm. So as Thomas pointed, we're not really looking to the law to, you know, we're not looking for the Supreme Court to go, oh, slap their foreheads and say, like, oh, we made a mistake. Corporations, what were we thinking? Corporations have rights. So it's really up to us in our communities to actually to be the change, as the book says, and to be Rosa Parks and to stand up in the places where we live and change the law to reflect what democracy really looks like.
You know, I have to laugh because that's the way it's often framed. You know, you just hear that over and over again. But I'd love to hear listeners' opinions on this because we have full lines. So let's go to Marie-Louise in Palo Alto.
Thank you.
Hi.
Well, can't say that I exactly can speak to your question, but for many years I've thought about what happened with Ralph Nader long ago. He and his group of people that were doing research, they found out that there was a paper company, I believe it might have been called the American Paper Company, on the Savannah River in Georgia. And they had been polluting wildly for years and years and years. And it was discovered that they had it in bylaws when that company settled there and started there that they were not to be responsible for the pollution of the river. I mean, it was actually written because they gave jobs to people, so therefore they were not responsible for this. And this crosses my mind, you know, very, very often. And I really love what I've heard today from Thomas, if I may call him that. And I just think that there's this thing about, you know, we, the people who really care for the earth and who try to do it in a gentle, caring way, probably we need to get angry from time to time. I don't mean violent, but, you know, this is really a horrible way of treating our earth, and it doesn't help to just put in a light bulb that is more less destructive,
right?
Less dangerous. Thank you so much for the program.
Okay,
I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Marie-Louise, and we'll take a few more calls, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Diane in San Francisco. Hi, Diane. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a very interesting subject, but I have to say I would reserve caution on environmentalism rights. To protect an environmental area, you may actually have an impact on, for instance, our agricultural industry. And in California, one of the best there is, where we were in the forefront of organic agriculture, et cetera. You want to protect the farmers and the ranchers that are providing the food to Californians, to the people. So some people don't understand how that's produced, and it's very complicated. They try to do it the best they can. I certainly don't believe in pollution or, for instance, the mistreatment of animals or of the earth. But if you make it right for the environment, you may actually push the farmers and ranchers into a position where they cannot, A, compete with corporations, because the corporations will have a slew of attorneys to take it to court. And the little guy, which is what we want to promote as far as sustainability, those are the ones that are really on the forefront of that. You're going to make it so that they are economically incapable of playing on that playing field. So
Diane, right. Stay on the line because that's a specific one. Thomas, what's your response? What do you think?
Well, it's interesting. This work actually began in rural South Central Pennsylvania with the farm community. And it's a tragedy, as the caller probably knows. I mean, in Pennsylvania alone, we've lost 300,000 farmers over the past 20 years. And that's due to this corporate consolidation, corporate concentration in the state. I think the numbers are probably similar elsewhere. And so a lot of those farmers came to us and they said, well, you know, this factory farm industry is about harnessing family farmers to this small number of corporations to consolidate and vertically integrate the factory farming and the livestock raising field. And they said to us, we want to ban factory farming, not because it's bad environmentally, but because it's bad economically for us, because it's in essence harnessing us to put our neighbor out of business. And so that's where this work started. It had very conservative rural roots. But on the rights of nature question, just to flip over to that for a moment, as essentially we have to come to a point where we understand that our economic systems work within limits. And those limits are ecological limits. And those ecological limits will assert themselves independently of what we do from a legal perspective. The job from a legal perspective is to bring the law into consonance with those ecological limits. And so right now, farming is done in such a way, mostly by the large agribusiness operators, that attempt to transcend those ecological limits. And in essence, we're barring against the future. And so not only do we have to take a family farm economy system and actually legalize that through a system of law, we also have to understand that we need to set constraints through the law to actually accelerate sustainability. And those constraints have to operate not only to dismantle the corporate agribusiness system that you're talking about, because I, for one, don't think we can have a family farm system operating within that corporate agribusiness sector. That we have to dismantle that corporate agribusiness sector, and then we have to understand the need to use the law to place some ecological limits on our activities, because otherwise you have to ask, what the hell are we doing here? Mm-hmm. Because if all we're doing is barring against the future because we can't somehow do agricultural production or energy or transportation or any of these other needs that we have without transcending the ecological limits, which means that we're burning future generations with ecological excess, which means that we're damaging them and destroying them as well, then we have to really, really take a hard look at exactly what we're doing as a society, because it seems it's like the drunk that's looking for his next drink or the drug addict looking for his next high. And so if we're really about sustainability, it means actually imposing those limits with an understanding that a diverse family farm economy is the only democratic, sustainable way to actually reach those.
If I could just add, this is Shannon,
sure.
Just to provide a little California perspective on that. The big agriculture produces most of what we produce here in California. California produces 50% of the fruits, nuts, and vegetables for the entire United States. So we produce not only for ourselves, but for the whole United States, and a lot of that doesn't include the imports, which we promote a majority of. That contributes 2-3% only to our GDP. That means that big agriculture also controls what water looks like here in this drought-ridden state, and the fact that we have, even in a good year, we're subsidizing corporate agriculture the whole system of corporate farming is anathema to sustainability. It cannot produce, as Thomas said, something sustainable, which is what communities in California are coming to, and why I have so many calls about food sovereignty and sustainability from cities like Santa Monica, yes, but also small farming communities. Folks in Mendocino are looking at this because they can't even give raw milk to their neighbors. The way that the laws and regulations are set, and particularly, not necessarily in California, but certainly present here, is that the whole system of subsidies and regulations is set up to keep small farmers out of the process. So when we have these small farmers who are finding themselves constricted and restricted, and the reason that so many people end up falling out of profitability in farming is because of the way that this whole system is set up. And it's what small farmers and communities are coming to. We want locally produced food that responds to the needs of the community. And we can't make that. It's not even legal for us to do that.
Diane, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
So what are your thoughts?
Well, again, I have to say, if you stress environmental rights or environmental ecosystem rights, I still think that the small farmer is going to be left in the dust. What about farmer rights instead, or the rights of the people to have this locally produced food or safe food, organic food, whatever they choose to eat. What about those rights? Why not press for that rather than saying environmental ecosystem rights? I mean, I think it's going to push a lot of people away because we know that most of the, for instance, endangered species have been laws that have come up on the federal and state level have impacted farmers and ranchers negatively. For instance, there's a new one that California, this little bird, I'm sorry, I don't know the name of the bird, but he only thrives, this bird, in burnt-out areas. So it's always been a very rare bird, and so now they're going to add him to the endangered species, even though he's always been rare. Well, he only thrives in burnt-out areas. So that could have an impact on good areas, thriving areas, because there aren't any of those. It's sort of, we get to the point where you get these farmers into a catch-22. They come in with the fish and game, California and the federal, and they start pushing farmers and ranchers around because they have these rights.
Thank you for calling. Thomas, do you want to give us a quick response? And I just want to make sure we get some more callers on the line.
Well, first of all, small farmers, family farmers have no rights. And part of this work is actually creating local bills of rights that protect producers as well as consumers of those products. So about 140 communities across the United States have passed similar ordinances at this point that create local bills of rights. And Shannon was referring to these food bill of rights, which have begun to be passed by some communities in Maine and elsewhere, that actually protect the right to produce of the small farmers. But the caller is right about one thing. Right now, family farmers have to compete against these corporate agribusiness conglomerates. And that's why in that system, which is a race to the bottom for agricultural production, you will never have a sustainable economic model existing when you have two of those poles, two of those diametrically opposite poles, when you have family farmers trying to compete with these agribusiness folks. And so part of this work is breaking apart those systems and understanding that corporate farming is not sustainable, as Shannon also said, and that sustainability needs to become the byword and the guiding light for communities, because all sustainability means is that we're not using more than what future generations can sustain. And in fact, taking a different look at our relationship with nature and a different look at our relationship with each other, as not as consumers and producers, but members of the same community who are working towards a common goal, which is quality of life and sustainable economic systems within those communities.
All right. Well, thanks again for the call. And we have about 10 minutes left. We're joined by Thomas Lindsay. He calls himself a recovering environmental attorney, and Shannon Biggs, director of Global Exchange's Community Rights Program. Let's try to get in as many callers as we can, and then we'll get thoughts from our guests. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I really appreciate your program.
Thank you.
And I'm talking out for the work of George Lakoff, who's talking about how we frame issues. And I feel like the environmental movement has been framed by the right wing as crazy or out of control or not logical. If anything, the environmental community seems to be more logical and more rational about where we're headed. Is there any way that you see that the communication that's going on out in society so that we could be framed in a way that people would accept?
Yes, and thank you. This is definitely an issue they write about, and we'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go to William in Belvedere. Hi, William.
Yes, thank you very much. There are some issues that should obviously can only be dealt with on a national level. An example would be something like air pollution from factories, where if you don't have national legislation, you have factories moving from one area to another area to avoid the rules, and then the economy is damaged in the area from which they left. On the other hand, it's been my observation in working on local kinds of issues that, at least my perception is, that to the extent that you can devolve government power to localities, although that may seem like a retrograde concept, to the extent that you can do that with respect to many issues, you'll be able to have better control. It's been my perspective that on issues of local, where you do things locally, that corporate interests are much less effective in having influence. And when they do attempt to come in with their big dollars, which is all that they can come in with, then the people are able to see things for what they are. So I'd appreciate the gentleman guest's perspective on the benefits of devolving power to local entities, local jurisdictions.
All right. Thank you for the call, William. Let's take another caller, and then we'll get a response. Let's go to Mark in San Francisco. Another Mark. Hi.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call. My question, first of all, thank you for the show. I think it's really stimulating. Thomas's ideas are really provocative. My question is this. How does he square his idea that things have not gotten better in the last 40 years with things like point source pollution in rivers? I'm thinking of Potomac River in Washington, D.C. that's been cleaned up substantially through water quality standard regulations, or air quality standards in Los Angeles getting better through air quality standard regulations. And is he suggesting that there's really no difference between the Democratic environmental agenda and the Republican one? And as voters, we don't really have a real choice there. And I'm just curious how he squares his point of view with those realities.
All right. Thank you for that, Mark. Thomas, why don't you tackle that one first?
Sure. We talk a lot about the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act and conventional environmental laws in our democracy school. The one law that folks have a lot of the most experience with is something called the National Environmental Policy Act, which is was passed in the 1970s to require environmental impact statements to be done for certain projects that use federal monies in the United States. And there's this myth that's grown around the country's environmental laws, including things like NEPA, that somehow they require the choice of the least environmentally damaging alternative for a project that's being proposed that uses federal money. And quite the opposite is true. NEPA is a disclosure document, which means you do the environmental impact statement. And even if it says you're going to destroy 80% of some habitat that exists to be mowed down for the project, it doesn't stop the project from occurring. It actually is just a disclosure document, and the agency can move forward with the project anyway. And so when people tout the benefits of laws like NEPA, you really have to look under the covers and see exactly what's happening there, because a lot of the environmental laws are disclosure only. And the Clean Water Act issues that the caller raised is very important. Our work is not to say that the planet would be worse off without those brave, courageous people who have gone to the front lines to pass things like regulatory limitations through the Clean Water Act. But we really have to be careful about overselling the benefits that have come from those laws. A lot of times when I talk about the Clean Water Act in lectures that we give at law schools, somebody will challenge and say, well, you know, rivers used to catch on fire before we passed the Clean Water Act. And that's very true. But if that's our measure of success in terms of passing environmental laws, we're in a lot of trouble in the United States. Because, you know, it's one thing to keep rivers from catching on fire. It's a whole nother thing to put into place a system that's actually going to stop ecological degradation of the waterways. And it's our somewhat controversial point that prior to the Clean Water Act, you had a lot of pristine waterways in the United States that could have degraded to the point of being fishable and swimmable. This is some legal jargon thrown in, but the Clean Water Act is a human-centered law which only looks at the drinkable and swimmable qualities of the water that we use in the United States. It's completely possible that more waterways decline for being pristine to meeting the minimum drinkable, swimmable standards than were actually brought up from catching on fire to being raised above the drinkable and swimmable standards under the Clean Water Act. And so we have to be very careful about buying some of the big green stuff about how good the environmental laws have been in this country. It's our contention that they have not been good enough, and they haven't been good enough because they're all anthropocentric. They're from a human point of view, and the standards will continue to evolve as regulatory standards under that system unless we understand that there's a need for ecosystems to have independent rights to exist and flourish of their own.
What about his question about the differences between the Democrats and the Republicans?
I'm not quite sure where that one was aiming. But the Democrats, of course, have been much friendlier to environmental legislation over the years. Republicans have not been so. I still find a difference between the policies of the two. But I think the new system that needs to be born, this one of community rights over corporate rights and nature's rights coming into being, which Ecuador has now adopted and about 36 communities in the United States have put in binding legal frameworks for, that's not going to come from the two traditional parties. it's got to come from a new constituency, because there is no pre-existing constituency that does this work, which is why the only folks we really work with over the past 8 years or so have been communities faced with impending corporate threats coming in, because it's only those folks in those communities. It's not the liberal progressive community, which has not touched this work by and large. It's the actual threatened communities who are in a position to begin to understand how this country was constructed to ensure that they are subordinate to the corporations coming in to put the projects into their community that they want to put in. And it's those folks who are able to hear the stuff about the U.S. constitutional structure. It's those folks who are willing to, in some ways, occupy their own community by saying, we're going to seize the structure of law here to actually build the structure that's going to enhance our authority and our ability to build sustainability in our community.
And Shannon, we only have a few minutes left, but when you put this into practice, you say the three main areas here in California focus on food sovereignty, water, and fracking. Can you talk about how people can actually get involved in this? What's most effective based on the work you've done?
Well, generally speaking, whenever Thomas and I or any of the organizers are out and about or on these radio shows, the number of calls come up, because a lot of people just don't know that this opportunity, that this work exists. And for many people, it, you know, they hear about it and they go, wow, I really resonated with that, and they call us. And those are kind of the frontline people that we're talking to. But in terms of contacting us, you can reach me at Global Exchange here in California. I'm in San Francisco, and I travel all over the state and elsewhere. And to contact the Legal Defense Fund, there are resources on both of our websites for more information. And you know, I'll be in my office after the show, waiting for people to call. So,
and are you seeing success stories that we're just not hearing about in the media?
Well, I think the success stories in California, this work is in many ways just it takes a while to take hold. We've had one law in Mount Shasta that was put forward and was stripped illegally, which is a story in a radio show, and in and of itself, it was stripped illegally by the county off the ballot. I'm working with I'm in conversation with dozens of communities in California, and a few which are really circling around putting forward the first California rights-based ordinance on the books, hopefully this year.
Well, we'll definitely continue to follow this. And Mark, your question to framing in the book, Be the Change, it says, instead of fighting against something, it's time to fight for something and create a vision of the community you want to bring into existence. So thanks for that call. Thomas Lindsay is a recovering environmental attorney, co-author of Be the Change, How to Get What You Want in Your Community. Shannon Biggs is director of Global Exchange's Community Rights Program and author of The Rights of Nature. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Rose.
Thank you, Rose.
And thanks for your calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the National Defense Authorization Act, now law, and has come under attack by civil liberties groups. There's a lot of confusion over what the law actually does. Are the media answering your questions? We'll also discuss coverage of the escalating political tensions in Libya. What grabbed your attention this week? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Where did you see the best reporting? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast or newsletter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is the executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor. And Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Alan Farley is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in San Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.